I want to tell you about a new investigative podcast called She Has a Name. It's about a young mother who disappeared in Detroit in the summer of 1987. She Has a Name tells the story of loss and redemption, mending broken family ties, and facing the trauma experienced by countless individuals who've lost loved ones to violence. Join host Tanya Mosley and her nephew Antonio as they unravel the secrets of what happened to Anita Wiley. You can search for She Has a Name in your podcast app.
This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with Carrie Jr. II, our producer. Is that our theme? We got it going.
I'm just hoping that it'll spark a few bars from you.
Somebody's got to write some lyrics over that.
I'm genuinely curious what your rap would sound like.
I think you are maybe the only person in all of Metro Detroit who has that curiosity.
Well, I don't know. Curious is one thing. I think it would be something very specifically unique to you. I think
that's for sure.
Hey, maybe we'll do it off mic.
I don't know that I'm going to do that. Everyone has to know their limitations.
That's fair.
So it is the weekly recap.
Weekly recap, yes.
And this week we've got a wide range of things to look back on. Mm. We had a conversation about racial ghosts, which you were not quite sure whether it was a literal description or a figurative one. It is figurative, this idea of the imprint of history on us and how it affects us from a racial perspective. We also had a conversation about marijuana use among students and children in schools, a really disturbing kind of report that is coming from Detroit school districts. And then we got ready for Movement, which is Memorial Day weekend. That's right. You're really good at that.
Thank you. I give you my credit.
We've discovered a new Carrie Jr. talent.
I don't know. It really only applies right now. I was like, might as well do it, you know, if I can actually do the techno beat.
Right.
You know,
we'll let you do it here.
Right. But yeah, three really good episodes. We're going to start with the racial ghost episode. We spoke with Dr. Dion Powell, who's a psychoanalyst, a training and supervising psychoanalyst at Columbia University. She does research in the realm of racial ghosts. And, you know, the way I simplify it, not literal ghosts, but I simplify it as internalized racism. How are we changed? How are our minds kind of altered by the experiences we have out in the world? And being othered.
Yeah.
And it applies to race, it applies to gender, it applies to sexuality, all of those sorts of things.
And it's about how deeply those things affect all of us. Yeah. So I want to start here. What are racial ghosts? Explain that phrase to me.
Okay. When we're born, we've had 9 months inside of a person, our moms. And, you know, whatever the mom was born, when the mom has gone throughout her life with the egg that becomes you and I. Right?
Right.
And so that any kind of trauma, generational trauma, actual trauma, depression, mental illness, addiction, growing up in a war zone, growing up in a poverty situation. All of those features have a way of impacting that child, you and I.
Because we're present inside our mothers from the beginning of their lives.
from the beginning of their lives as an egg, and mm-hmm. then in beginning in our of our lives
right.
as a fetus that becomes a baby that becomes delivered.
So to go back to your bat analogy, it's essentially that the understanding of how to survive as that species is passed along from mother to child, so that the child comes out ready to survive.
Ready to absorb, ready to engage.
Okay.
And we call it labor because it is an act of labor to be born, right? And so those initial interactions, a baby can make out their mother's face within 30 days of life.
Mm-hmm.
They already know how she sounds, right? So they're cued in to that mother's responses, emotions, affects. They don't know what to describe it as, right? They don't have language yet. But let's say that mother is depressed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let's say that mother is the product of, has had some traumas in her life. The way she engages with her child may be imbued with all of those traumas. Mm-hmm. In spite of herself.
It's certainly shaped by them, right?
Right. It's shaped by her and those micro interactions. Remember, children are supercomputers. We haven't even gotten to the point of developing something like a child's mind and
mm-hmm.
brain.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a transgenerational history of trauma that could be racial, that could be from war, that could be from the Holocaust, that could be from being in poverty situations, it could be from sexual trauma, it could be from mental illness, it could be from addiction. The mother's interaction will shape the child.
Right.
And so you see films of mothers with babies. And the mother might be depressed, but when she looks at the baby, she has a smile on her face that's really sort of quick and mm-hmm. and in some ways startling. And then when she's thinking that the baby's not looking at her, her face could become pinched and in all consumed by whatever's going on in her mind, the mother's mind. The baby sees this and reaches out for the mother, attempting to get her to be warm and fuzzy, right? This is all we got. We don't have bat wings.
Right.
And depending on that interaction over and over again, certain things get inside our minds about who to fear, why we fear, in a way that we don't even have language to put it at.
Right. And so to put that in a racial context then, the discrimination that a mother might experience, the historic discrimination that she might have heard about in her family,
right.
all passes on in a subconscious, I guess, way. I mean, this is right. not intentional, you're talking about.
Right. This is not intentional.
It gets communicated very early.
It gets communicated very early, but without words. And then certain things happen, like we go to school and someone says, I can't play with you because of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And we begin to define a kind of otherness. You're in my group. You're not in my group. And some of that is conveyed even within one's home. If you begin hearing, for instance, like let's say the N-word, or mm-hmm. if you hear something that's anti-Semitic, or if you hear something that's against a particular sexuality. And you begin to take these things inside. And of course, your parents are loving you and trying to protect you. And with 400 years of systemic racism, slavery, Jim Crow, lynching, there's a kind of embeddedness to how we are conveying who the other is and who to be afraid of or weary of or cautious around.
So, in some ways, and this is, I mean, in some ways, the assessment you're making here suggests that it's impossible to exist as an African American without the weight of all that history on your shoulders. And that's a really bold idea to think about, right? All the things we want to believe about self-determination, all the things we want to believe about progress and independence and freedom, they kind of crumble at the altar of what you're talking about, right? Like,
well, maybe yes and maybe no. It really does depend on the caretakers and how they've dealt with it. Because in addition, we Black people, African Americans, have had to have tremendous resilience, right?
Yes.
In order to be
just
able
to survive,
survive and also thrive, thrive. I mean, we in certain instances, a lot of folks have been able to, you know, bring themselves up, want to bring up other people, and provide a context in which the child can experience the world.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's overdone. It's hard to get a balance, especially if the person has their own internalized fears and anxieties that they haven't actually worked through.
I'm curious.
So I'm not saying that every child is bearing the weight of 400 years.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that would seem almost impossible. We would not be able to live, but we've had certain ways of expressing our pain through the blues, through the church, through other connections, fraternities, sororities, just being able to engage with other people who are considered the other and not have some of those fears mitigated through reality, through relationships, right?
Yeah. Dr. Pa, I want to, what other examples are there of parents passing along these ghosts that exemplify like what these ghosts look like and manifest? I know you gave the example about, you know, the mother and her face, but are there other verbal like behaviors that were taught at a young age that also are in alignment with what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think, I mean, going back a couple of decades, the whole idea of what to do in the South if you're Black and you're walking on the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certain people are, you know, were instructed. If a white person is coming along, step off the sidewalk. And for a young child, they may not know what the parent's referring to. Now, hopefully you give some context of why you might need to step off the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at what's recently happened in the world from, you know, driving while or walking while Black, right? That usually typically leads to conversations where you have to inject a kind of fear that you have to be mindful, especially if you're in a foreign neighborhood. I mean, I think it's reflected in the film Get Out by Jordan Peele so well, that you have to be mindful that you can't be a normal kid if you're, for instance, Tamir Rice in a park playing with a plastic gun.
Right.
And so that kind of fear gets sort of put in people, and sometimes to the point where it scares the child.
They're scared of the environment.
Scared of the environment, scared of being out, scared of being playful.
And scared of being yourself.
Scared of being oneself.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. That was researcher Dion Powell talking about the racial ghosts that we all live with here in America. When we come back, we're going to have a conversation about marijuana use and our children. After the legalization of marijuana here in the state of Michigan, we're seeing some unintended consequences. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Back with Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson here with Carrie Jr. II. We're about to talk about a pretty serious subject. The legalization of marijuana here in the state of Michigan has meant a new freedom. It is available for people to enjoy. But I remember when we were talking about this, I said I thought there would be some unintended negative consequences. And this week we talked about one of them.
Yes, yes. The Michigan Poison and Drug Information Center reported an increase in unintentional cannabis use among children age 13 and younger over the last few years. And it's gotten the attention of our school officials because this is also prevalent in the school system. Detroit Public School Community District Superintendent Nikolai Vitti, he said there were more than 750 incidents involving cannabis use and vape pens for tobacco just this school year. Robin Vincent from Chalkbeat Detroit wrote that in the most severe cases of unintentional ingestion of cannabis, that the child's respiratory system could be compromised. So we speak to her, and we also speak with Dr. Varun Vora, who she spoke with for this story. Dr. Vora is the director of the Michigan Poison and Drug Information Center at Wayne State University. We spoke to them to get more information about how the children are ingesting it and to better understand what can be done to reduce or slow this trend.
Yeah, and a key part of this conversation is about the state level, right? Mm-hmm. The governor, the legislature, what can they do to add a better and tighter regulatory scheme to this new freedom to make sure that kids don't get access to these drugs?
Mm-hmm.
Robin, I want to start this segment with a little bit of sound from Nikolai Vitti, who is the superintendent of the Detroit Public School District.
There needs to be more conversations, more thoughtfulness, and more guardrails put in place so we're protecting our youth as we have better protected adults with the criminalization of marijuana. Now we have to protect our youth with the decriminalization of marijuana.
So that was the superintendent talking about this letter, right, that that he and the school board have sent to the legislature and to the governor.
That's right. So Vitti was saying that, you know, it's a real balancing act, right, when it comes to decriminalizing marijuana. We know that Black and brown communities were hit the hardest back when weed was criminalized, and they continue to feel the effects of that. And Vitti said, you know, that's one reason it made sense to legalize it, yeah. Right? But now, again, we're going to keep going back to this phrase. We're facing now the unintended consequences of trying to sort of level that playing field by legalizing marijuana.
Yeah, yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Let's start today with Jacqueline in Detroit. Jacqueline, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind is that my son, my grandson, Kaden Maluli, who's mm-hmm. 9 years old, mm-hmm. spoke in front of city council mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago regarding this same issue. His issue is that he lives in Beverly Hills. However, when he come to visit me in Detroit, once it's almost like he hit 8 Mile, is that the advertisement for cannabis and free cannabis increases. And his thing is that children can be misled.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is what he said. Malachi actually wrote an article about Kaden in Bridge, Detroit,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. regarding being misled by the sketchy advertising that these companies do. Because children, you know, don't understand. I had to explain to him about the advertisement.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just wanted to mention that even the children
I think that's a great point to bring up, Jacqueline. I quickly want to ask you, what part of the city you live in, and I guess how prevalent both the advertisements for marijuana are and the availability, like dispensaries and things? Are they close by where you live?
Okay. I live on the east side near Cadieux and Mac. However, you know, naturally, he comes, when he visits, it's through the freeway. And I-75 coming down from 696, once you hit like 9 miles, I mean, it's just loads of signs regarding, well, you know, some of them. I don't know if I can mention their name, but I mean, you've seen them.
Sure.
And so once he comes, you know, down into the city, it's like, and then even at the, what was it, the NFL draft, he was taking pictures of one of them that had a helicopter with a sign because he thought it was a crime. You know how people film crimes?
Yeah.
So he said, I'm going to film them and report them.
Jacqueline, I really appreciate that you called and shared that information. And, you know, congrats to your grandson as well. Yep. It's a big deal at 9 years old to go down to city council and tell them that this is a big problem. Dr. Vora, this question about advertising and packaging is a huge part of this, how we allow the dispensaries to market themselves.
Yeah, you're right, exactly. So, I mean, right now there's no real federal regulation for the packaging of edibles. And, you know, as Robin alluded to, Michigan does have certain packaging standards, how compliant a lot of these companies may be. I think it kind of toes the line and or how enforced these are. So I think a really prudent way to capitalize on the economic boom and revenues that these products are generating for sales is to put that back into the system, right? To provide product packaging reform, whether it's to better make them more child resistant, perhaps more inconspicuous labeling, to not make them as enticing to young kids. And I think it's sort of a multi-pronged discussion, right? So as we talked about before, I think a low-hanging fruit would be the role of the parent and the guardian as well, and I'm sure we'll get into. But I think sort of that combined spearheaded effort between more innovative packaging reform combined with more sort of parental or guardian oversight would at least help sort of mitigate these numbers that we're seeing.
Yeah, yeah. We had a caller from Livonia, Scott, who couldn't stay on the line, but he says this was foreseeable. What did we think would happen? He's not against legalization, but where is our common sense? A great question. Dr. Vora, when we think about the ways that we could, I guess, protect against the marketing of this to kids, what are the things that I guess come to your mind?
Yeah, so immediately things that come to my mind is, you know, speaking from our State Poison Control Center perspective, because we serve many different roles, I guess you could say, is that we offer sort of a clinical management perspective, but a big part of what we do is public health outreach, education, programming, messaging, et cetera. So a lot of the things that we often tell, whether it's on our social media platforms, whether it's on our field visits, et cetera, again, that sort of low-hanging fruit of messaging directly to those affected, whether it's kids, guardians, caretakers, et cetera. So very low-hanging stuff, keeping these products out of the sight and out of reach of children. It sounds very basic, but you'd be surprised that people get distracted, right, and leave things lying around in the vicinity of very curious children. And that's why we call it a lot of these times these exploratory ingestions, right? So they're unintentional. Kids are enticed. They see something maybe that looks like candy or what have you, something that they've seen before. But it's not obviously that. Not using while children are around, right? Yeah. So designating a time when maybe the kids are gone to bed or they're away at a friend's or what have you, dedicating that time to using when they are not in sight as well, when the parent or the kids aren't around, keeping them in a locked cabinet. So again, very basic. We think about, you know, the previous days with keeping the liquor cabinet sort of locked, you know, when a person's having a house party or something and the parents are away. Something like that with young kids, they're not going to have sort of the tactile skill or know how to to access those cabinets, and then keeping them in their original package and closed again, with combined with a locked cabinet, and then keeping them somewhere safe and out of reach and out of sight where kids aren't going to go explore. I think those are, so again, low-hanging fruit interventions that the parents can make to sort of mitigate at least the risk in their household.
Yeah. So hearing you talk about that reminds me a lot of the way we talk about firearms and kids, right? The level of responsibility that I think that we are at least trying to attach to adults to be able to exercise the freedoms that they have with regard to, you know, guns, but also to keep children from interacting with them.
Precisely. And I think historically, if you know, with substances that have been made, if you go back through various examples, substances that are made increasingly available, there is sort of a statistically commensurate increase with pediatric exposures to those products. So again, it's just a product or byproduct of accessibility. And I think a lot of the other side of that coin is conflating something that's legal or accessible as being safe, which we clearly have seen with multiple examples is just not true. So I think, you know, the interventions that we recommend, that we tout and champion on our various platforms, on our website, social media, et cetera, combined with, again, say, in our role with the Poison Center, where we go directly to schools, right, with our educator, and our educators go to schools, talk about this issue, get in front of the kids, get in front of the parents. I think more and more of that, you know, it can kind of have sort of a snowball effect, at least in helping to get that messaging out there to say that, you know, just because this is safe, you see this in stores, does not mean it's safe. Yeah. So I think it's, again, a multi-pronged effort.
Yeah, yeah. Robin, what would the school district say about how this fits into the broader context of drug use in the schools and unintended drug interaction in the schools?
I'm so glad that you are posing that question, Stephen, because interestingly, Superintendent Vitti at Detroit Public Schools said that they're not really dealing with illicit drugs. The big issue is cannabis and vape pens. Hmm. And as I mentioned earlier, vape pens are making up the vast majority of incidents, and then cannabis would be a second.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as...
And the vape pens are generally just, I mean, it's tobacco.
Tobacco,
use.
That's
not drugs.
Right. That's right. And that also, though, we can trace that back to what kids are seeing from adults, because I'm sure that you can think of instances where you're out in public and, or you're, no, let me rephrase that. You're in an enclosed space where someone probably should not be pulling out a vape pen. And they are, and they're doing it like sort of in this like clandestine kind of way. And it's like, yeah, kids are seeing this.
Yes, yes.
And they're emulating this behavior.
Yeah. That was our conversation about the rise in incidents involving young children and marijuana here in the state of Michigan. When we come back, we're going to look forward to the weekend and a conversation that we had about movement and the origin of techno here in the city of Detroit. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Look and listen to that techno beat in the background.
maybe Connor, our music, our producer engineer, will add some techno beat at the bottom of that.
Nice music around it. That would be cool. It's time to talk about movement, Memorial Day weekend, techno, and the origins of that music here in the city of Detroit. I'm really, really glad we got to do this week. And Adriel Thornton is one of the people I think of first when I think of the scene around techno that emerged in the 90s and has continued and grown. We talked to him about the history of the music and the history of the culture.
Yeah, he was a real catalyst of spaces for that kind of stuff back then, too, right?
Yeah. Would throw parties anywhere in the city, anywhere he could.
Right.
And welcome people from a really broad spectrum of backgrounds. And that was a really key thing to be doing in Detroit in the 90s, which was a very strange and kind of conflicted decade for the city. So we talked with him about all of these things and got ready for the Funky Dance Festival coming this festival. Memorial Day weekend. So let's go back 30 years. There is no electronic movement festival or event really in Detroit. Talk about how different it was then, and I guess how hard it was to get all this started.
Right. I think Detroit had a really interesting and robust club and rave scene, like a party scene. I was a rave promoter and a club promoter. I think that, I mean, obviously it was much smaller.
Yeah.
Right? The people who were participating in it, the amount of people, it was much smaller and in a weird kind of way, much more authentic, right? But that's not to say that anything, you know, growth is not bad.
Yeah.
Right. But you had to find it, right? And it was, you know, I remember, you know, having to explain to people, you know, still, even then, like what techno was or like what this music was or like what real, you know, back then people really, I think, had, and when I say people, I'm saying like more mainstream folks or whatever, had, you know, their idea of what, when we talked about going to the club or to the party or whatever, to them they equated to, okay, it's a, they go into the bar.
Right.
Right?
Which is not what you
and
meant.
Right, exactly. Not what I meant. And so it's hard for them to really wrap their heads around the difference between the two, right?
I mean, it is hard to explain, I think, to a lot of folks what Detroit in the 90s was like for music, for culture, and for this kind of emerging culture that is now very widely understood, but it was different back then. It kind of stood alone.
Yeah, it stood alone. It was, you know, I'll tell you something culturally. Detroit in the 90s was our playground.
Yeah, right.
Right. And so is, you know, when you look at it from, you know, like today's standards, is, you know, those empty buildings and things were, to us, they weren't really signs of decay. And it's hard to say that, right? They weren't signs of decay and neglect. It's what I saw, you know, all we wanted to do at the train station was throw a party out of it, like throw like a massive event there. You know, it's so funny to go to some of these buildings downtown, and I swear I'll be talking with you know, maybe some work colleagues or something like that, and say, oh yeah, I threw a party here, and like, and now it's some fancy, it's really hot restaurant, right?
Yeah.
So we didn't have that though back then, right? It was, you know, when I remember the first festival we went to, the first DEMF we went to, us, the whole, you know, the whole crew and everybody was working, we did like an after, on that Tuesday, went to, tried to go to breakfast, and the hottest place was Anita Baker's IHOP.
Yeah, right.
And we got there, and it was like, they didn't have eggs, they didn't have milk. The festival had blown them out. But that was it. There was no, I mean, there were a few other options, but you really couldn't, that was.
There wasn't other places to go.
Right. There was one start, there was, I think we started, there wasn't a Starbucks, and then the second year there was. No, I'm sorry, that Starbucks was there on Congress.
Okay.
It had just opened. Everybody was super excited because Detroit had gotten a Starbucks. Yeah. And, but then they were closed.
Yeah.
On the, during the weekend, and we told them, we begged them to open up next year. I was like, all of us need a coffee. Right. So it's, you know, navigating that. So I think the nightlife aspect of it was it was just so much more fun. To me, right? And I think that, you know, obviously, you know, I was a little younger then. But
we were all a little younger then, right?
But it was fun and it was funky. And it was, I think it was really, we were exploring a lot of different ways of doing things.
Yes.
And musically, they were exploring a lot of different
things. And I think you can't talk about the music, which was kind of finding its place, mm-hmm. And expanding and growing, but also the culture itself,
yeah.
and the other parts of that culture that were pushed out or yeah. ostracized at the time.
There were, you know, and I'm glad you said that because, you know, my contribution to all of this has been as an event producer, right? As a promoter, that's been the art of what I've done to this thing. So creating those spaces, right? And we oftentimes when we talk about, especially in electronic music, we talk a lot about the DJs, the producers, and this is no disrespect to them, but the space, the people who were going to those places, right? The crowd, mm-hmm. you know, was really what made this thing special. And then what carried, it kind of, you know, all of these people became advocates for the music and for the sound. And having a place to congregate and to share, you know, share that music, you know, I hate to keep referring to this as the mainstream, but this was really underground back
it
then,
was.
Right? So, you know, you couldn't, you know, talk about this crazy abstract thing that, you know, Green Velvet just made or, you know, or that Derek had put out or anything like that to your average person because they didn't know.
They wouldn't know.
They had no clue
yeah.
about it. So having being able to have these spaces where you could, you know, it sounds just so general, but like that be around like-minded people. Was really I think really important, and really really gave home to a lot of people, and
yeah.
you know there's a lot of different reasons.
I mean, and there's the music, there's the art,
mm-hmm.
there's also the identity,
yeah,
that went along with all of that,
yeah.
that was not mainstream at all in
right.
the 90s, but in Detroit because. You know, as you point out,
yeah.
you know, it felt a lot of the time in the 90s, like everyone just got up and left, right? And we were still here. And
right.
there was these things, these spaces mm-hmm. that you could go to and do things that you couldn't have done before.
Right.
But it gave space to all kinds of people who didn't feel like they had space before.
100%. You know, you know, if you think about a place like Heaven,
yeah.
right,
mm-hmm.
which was black, gay, after hours at 7 and Woodward, I made this joke, you know, that,
right.
that forever church is the forever right. church construction that built is.
They'll get it done someday.
Right, someday, God willing. right.
Don't make fun.
I know. But, you know, that you know, was helmed by, you know, the late, great Ken Collier, who was the godfather of house in Detroit, just hands down. No one's going to argue that. And it was a teacher to, you know, quite a few other DJs,
yeah.
you know. But the space that was created was, you know, I think one of the most liberating places you could ever go. And, you know, people who went there, especially the queer community, you know, who were in the 90s were still battling real safety issues.
Yeah. There was an epidemic.
Yeah, there was a
was not recognized as that.
Yeah, exactly, right? They were still fighting, you know, the AIDS epidemic, right? And still a part of it and still being impacted by it huge, like in a really big way, you know? So you're dealing with people who we're dealing with loss
mm-hmm.
a lot of times, right? People you knew, you know, were probably, you know, there were quite a few who probably weren't here next week or
yeah.
right then, you know.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with that. You were dealing with, you know, ostracizing that comes along with it. And here's the space. We could just come in and you could leave all of that at the door,
mm-hmm.
right? And come in and, you know, create, you could be part of this community who understood it, but you didn't necessarily need to talk about it. I mean, unless you wanted to, right? But people just got it, right? But the thing is that, you know, I think people could also create personas of who they were. You could come in and be something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave people, I think, that real mental and emotional break that they needed in order to cope with real life. You know, this magic is only going to last for a few hours, right? So I think those spaces were really important and literally probably saved some people's lives, you know, by being able to go and be part of community. It's you know, I don't think that can be understated.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
And so it's hard for me to think of movement or techno without the association with the culture and with the identity, right? Mm-hmm. Do you think that's still true now? I mean, when I think of the 90s, that's how I think of it. Is movement still reflective
of which culture? Of queer culture?
Of the idea of that openness to culture?
It's hard to say.
Yeah.
Right. It's, I think.
It's more commercial.
It's more, I was going to say.
Right? It's bigger. It's more commercial.
Yeah. And I think.
It's more mainstream.
Yeah.
So that automatically. Alters the picture some, right?
Thank you, right, yeah. But in a weird, so in its way, yes, but it's kind of like in a freak show kind of maybe going to Vegas kind of way. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, we're going to wear some fuzzy boots and we're going to, you know, and it's almost like it is in a, I hate to say it, but I think that it's just in a sort of cliche way.
Huh.
And definitely not authentic, right?
Really?
And I say that because, so we're in what we, there's, the mainstreaming of it, I think, has in a weird kind of way, from a scene or a crowd standpoint, really sort of taken away the necessity of being really different, right? I think who it attracts is different. Right? I'll say this. There's difference between the regulars at those places.
Right. All right? Right.
And, you know, and then the people who are just kind of passively going.
Yeah.
You could take it back to club world for a second or the party scene. You know, another thing that's changed really between 30 years ago and now, even though we see sort of a resurgence of this, right? But, you know, there was a real physical threat to things, right? The whole point is that, again, this was stuff that was... It was underground, and there was a sense of danger to it because it, well, quite frankly, there was. You know, you could maybe go to jail that night, you know. And then really thinking about some of the places that we did parties in, I am happy to be
here.
They
weren't safe.
Right. I'm really happy to be here
right now. They were fun, but they were
right, right, right.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, it's you know, parallels to, you know, the, you know, back to the sort of danger element of it. And
well, I mean, it was just... you know, the city was losing so much in that decade. I feel like that was the worst decade of existence for the city of Detroit. Like all the people that left, all the businesses that left, all the buildings that went empty, the homes that went abandoned. And then you had this kind of fun outlet, that just was emerging, right?
Right.
And that hadn't existed before that could find its space in the emptiness.
I think that's really important, and I think that is actually an important piece of the story. I think that specifically Detroit's raven techno culture probably could not have existed the same way, at least in a healthy functioning city. You know, what was able to the magic the thing that was able to create it. I don't know anyone who actually broke into a warehouse,
right?
Right, to do a party, right? Yeah. You just had to come up with a creative story to get it read, right? Right. But it's. I did a lot of video shoots. I'll tell you, right? We did a video shoot.
That's right.
You know, but the thing is that the reason you could, you know, we didn't have to break into an empty warehouse or something like that was these people were dying to have somebody rent it. You know. Even just for a night.
Just to occupy
it. You know, the auxiliary businesses that, while others were leaving the city, you know, we just started to turn into an industry, right? Mm-hmm. So you had, you know, record labels. You know, I worked at Transmap with Laura Gavore for a hot minute, you know, over in Eastern Market. You know, it was a lot like small little loft space, mm-hmm. but this is what was happening. You know, Kevin, you know, Kevin Saunderson. Yeah, I was trying to say, should I just explain his whole name? You know, Kevin was the only business I knew that he had his offices, the KMS offices were in the Cadillac before it closed, right? There were a couple of other
before
businesses.
Before it closed.
Right before it closed, right? Yeah. So, you know, these were still businesses, right? The labels and stuff like that. And then, you know, the parties, again, helped sustain that industry. I had a clothing store below Zoot's Coffee Shop, if you remember where Zoot's Coffee Shop was. I was able to open up a sort of rave clothing store. You know, it was called Space 19. There was, you know, we had our own clothing line called Digital Laundry. But, you know, you had brands like Daniel Pooh, whoever. Now you've got these, you know, now you've got clothing lines and T-shirt lines. And these were all dedicated to, like, it was really just rave culture, right? Mm-hmm. You had magazines. I sold Herb Magazine and Accelerator Magazine. And then I sold people's mixtapes. And it was like, you know, I mean, it was really a story based on rave culture. But, you know, I opened it up in the basement, you know, downstairs unit of Zoot's Coffee Shop, and I was paying $75 a month for rent.
Wow.
You know, it's, you can't, like, where else?
Right.
You
know, where else in the world could that have happened?
Yeah, you know, and so other cities, this is not, you know, other cities you can do something similar, but you're going to be paying a whole lot more money. Your mm-hmm. startup capital has to be a lot greater. And here, Detroit, it was so easy to get from point A to point B. Yeah. You know, it really was, and I think still is in some extents, but that was also magical, right? Like, I mean, I was a kid, and I just decided to open up a store and could.
You could do it, right?
You know what I'm saying? And you did, you know? And so it was, when I think about it, it's like, that was hot, but it was also bananas. Like, where else could you do that?
Why is this happening?
Right, yeah. So, but I was able to do that. You know, that store became... a lot of people know it as the Checkpoint.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, because it was a space that we had.
Yeah.
When I say we, it was like that we had.
Yeah.
And you know, so on a, you know, Friday or Saturday night, you know, that's, you showed up there to get the tickets.
Yeah.
For the party, right? Or the map or whatever, right? So, you know, just having. You know, having that kind of, I just really got warm and fuzzy inside, to be honest with you. Well, because that was, you know, it was such a fun and creative and interesting time. And like you said, it's, again, like, I don't necessarily think that people, I don't know if I'll ever be able to explain how the club was home or how the party was home to so many people. You know, it was for me. I lived for those days, mm-hmm. you know, and it was where you, again, you saw so many of your family members, right? Chosen family members, you know, and it was, you just, I mean, I am friends with people to this day that I met in front of a speaker.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know. I mean, you know what
excellent.
I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
So it's, it really is, I think the impact that it has on again, folks is, you know, and again, I know people, really, I'm not going to get into some other stories, but who, being able to get to the party or the club was literally prevented them from doing something to themselves.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and just like, okay, if I could just get there and like, you know, and then they, you know, they get to have something for a minute and chat with somebody and stuff. And I legit know several people who saved their lives.
Yeah.
Right? It probably has saved mine, to be honest with you.
In that conversation, for me, it was really powerful to talk about how the spaces that he helped create, but that existed for Black and queer people in mm-hmm. Detroit, mm-hmm. helped save lives. And then also how it couldn't have happened anywhere else but Detroit.
Yeah.
How Detroit had,
yeah.
You know, it was a perfect kind of storm of unfortunate economic circumstances and people leaving the city, but also leaving these spaces that people found a way to occupy, found a way to to find community in.
Yeah.
And it's a spirit that I know exists in different cities, but it's something that I think also still exists here, where we always talk about our grit and our ability to like do something with less,
mm-hmm.
Especially in our creative community. I feel like that still lives on today.
Yeah.
Nothing to add.
What? Nothing to add. No, I thought it was
just gonna
good.
Just going to do me a solo?
That was great.
A solo out?
Yeah. That was good.
Okay.
That'll do it for us on Created Equal. Be sure to listen to our recent episodes at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is done by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.